It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
I have spent so many hours looking at the devastation in Florida that I just want to start with something more upbeat before we turn to the hurricane. And that is Aaron Judge of the New York Yankees hitting his 61st homer yesterday, tying the record of Roger Maris. Now, Roger Maris, also a Yankee, set that record of 61 big ones in 1961, which was 61 years ago. And everybody seems to like Aaron Judge. He's not flamboyant. In the previous game, he'd been walked 4 times, which I think is a crime against humanity. But he put one, it looked like a powerful blast, to tie Maris and was congratulated by everybody. And now he has about 7 games or so to see if he can go one past the late New York Yankee. And the reason this is such a big deal, in my view, not just that it would be a new American League record, is that the 3 National League players who hit far more than 61, they were all bulked up in the steroids era. I don't understand why Major League Baseball doesn't wipe out those records. They were cheating. It's BS. And if you knock them out, the real home run record was set a long time ago by Maris. Maris and Mantle, I remember in that season, I was just very young, were battling each other to see who could possibly break Babe Ruth's 60 home run record. And Mantle, as I recall, ended up with 54 homers, Maris with 61. So tip of the cap to Maris. And let me just get this in. Marjorie Taylor Greene, the controversial, sometimes QAnon following congresswoman, her husband has filed for divorce. Ordinarily, I would care less, her personal life. Why would we even talk about it? But DailyMail.com has a story saying that during their marriage, the now congresswoman openly cheated on her husband, one with a tantric sex guru and then with a gym manager. Both of these men were called. They didn't deny it, but they didn't want to talk. It was said to be an open secret. Marjorie Taylor Greene is blasting this as tabloid garbage and being spread by a communist. I don't know who the alleged communist is, but let's just say it's not the kind of story you want out there in the final weeks of the midterms. All right, number one, what's happening in Florida looks catastrophic in many areas. And as we've been saying, and meteorologists have been saying, and journalists have been saying all along, the initial hit of the storm, which was a Category 4, just a couple of miles an hour below a Cat 5, is bad enough as it barreled its way through Florida. At the moment that I'm speaking, it's approaching the Orlando area and has been downgraded to just a tropical storm. But there are questions about what will happen if it goes out to the Atlantic. Could it regain strength? It's predicted to move up the coast to the Carolinas and Virginia. So a lot of places are going to be getting a whole lot of rain and wind, even if not at the level of a Cat 4 hurricane. But as I was saying, as almost everybody has been saying, the greatest danger comes after the impact from the storm surges and flooding unleashed by Ian. This was the same thing that happened after Katrina. The one thing I want to throw in here is that it could have been worse. Now, as I'm speaking, there are no official reports of fatalities. That undoubtedly will change. Hopefully, the number will turn out to be low. But the reason I say it could have been worse is this. The storm was widely predicted, and you never know about the path of a hurricane, to hit Tampa, one of the biggest population centers in Florida and on the west coast of Florida, the Tampa St. Pete area. But it missed Tampa and struck about 100 miles to the south. That means when I saw the FEMA administrator Dean Cardwell, who seems to be on top of it, at least in terms of her public presentation. What she is saying, and what everyone else in the state is saying, is that the worst hit areas are Lee County and Fort Myers, and to some extent Naples. And so those are just less populated areas. So if that intensity had hit Tampa and St. Petersburg, I think more people would have been at risk. As of now, Tampa Bay surges are forecast to reach 6 feet, which certainly is nothing to dismiss. Fort Myers has recorded surges up to 12 feet. And there, it may be even higher. I've read or seen 16 or 17 feet. Now, that is where the real danger comes. Because in Naples, for example, and this morning a lot of stations were replaying the footage from yesterday of cars almost completely covered and so forth. Well, that has receded. But, you know, television always goes for the most dramatic footage. And right now, either there isn't as dramatic footage from the storm surges. It probably will be later in the day. The sun was just coming out. Or journalists couldn't get to these places because a lot of the roads were impassable. I mean, in Naples, I think a lot of homes and condos have been ruined because 6 feet of water, while it's not, it can be devastating because of the strength that the water moves. And a lot of the homes and condos there weren't built to withstand that kind of water because most of the hurricanes in Florida hit along the East Coast. And this was relatively rare. Now, the fact that there's been a lot of damage so far, 2.5 million people without power. For many of those people, that may last a long time. It's going to cost billions and billions of dollars. There's just so much work to do, including rescuing people who are sheltering in place, but who can't get out of their homes, didn't evacuate. And it's just not a pretty picture. We'll know more, I think, today and tomorrow about the flooding and what that causes. And it's, you know, one of the things that really strikes me at this, because the west coast of Florida has not been as prone to hurricanes as, you know, we're all used to seeing hurricanes hitting Palm Beach, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and making their way up the east coast. I think it was New York Times had a map showing the population surge along the west coast of Florida. And it just it is up 200%, 300%, and more in some of the most desirable areas. People get second homes there, or they move there to retire, or whatever. I mean, it's Florida. And so that now means if there are more hurricanes like Ian hitting the Gulf Coast, hitting the west coast of Florida, there are a lot more people there to suffer and be faced potentially life-threatening floods. You know, I get it. People want to go to communities where they think they'll be safe and wonderful climate and nice warm weather. But, you know, I don't think there's any question. This is not a conspiracy theory that the warming of the waters is making for more storms along to the magnitude of Superstorm Sandy. So, you know, President Biden was out there talking about it yesterday. Governor Ron DeSantis has given multiple briefings. But everybody knew the day after, and possibly the day after that, would be the most dangerous, aside from the impact of the hurricane itself. And it's hard to watch. You know, it's hard to watch areas where the roads have just become impassable. I mean, FEMA and local law enforcement want to get out there. The most devastating picture I've seen is of a hospital, and this may be true of several hospitals in that Lee County area, that have been flooded and the patients had to be moved to different floors. Or in one case, I think they did move them to another hospital where they would be safer. I mean, can you imagine being in a hospital, being treated for some disease or needing surgery, and suddenly the hospital is flooded? That is just heartbreaking. And it's hard to watch this, you know, and not feel the emotion. My sister lives along the east coast of Florida, and she tells me that with all the evacuation orders on the west coast, a lot of people went to the east coast of Florida, and every single hotel room all along that coast is booked. Every shelter is full. You couldn't get flights out, and the airports have now been closed in much of Florida. So a lot of devastation, a lot of human suffering. We don't know the full extent of it. We don't have any casualty numbers now, but I'm sure we will. And I hope that many lives can be saved now that the storm, I mean, it'll be out of Florida probably by late today. But the floodwaters and the storm surges are going to be the biggest single obstacle for first responders and others to rescue people who need to be rescued. It's all of the human effort that can be done versus the awesome destructive power of Mother Nature. So powerful, it has overwhelmed virtually all of the news, as it should be. This is the biggest and most important story in the country right now. Even the January 6th committee had to cancel its hearing for yesterday. So it is difficult to watch, as I say, and yet maybe in the end, casualties will be minimized and the rebuilding will begin. I hope that, and I'm sure all of America hopes that as well.
Hey, let's pause right there. The Buzz Meter continues right after this.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a three-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
Number two, the one thing that doesn't get put on hold, even in the face of a horrible and deadly storm in Florida, is the brutal war in Ukraine. And so the Russians just finished this completely sham referenda in those breakaway provinces with pro-Russian sentiment, you know, conducted at gunpoint. How fair is that? And announcing, you know, this will now be part of Russia and it will be a considered attack on Russia. Well, nobody pretty much on the planet is buying this. So the European Union is proposing a series of new sanctions aimed at punishing Russia for also escalating the war by drafting at least 300,000 men into its army, more on that in a moment, threatening the use of nuclear weapons, which is pretty much all a desperate Vladimir Putin can do at this point, and holding these discredited referenda in the occupied territories. So these include an oil price cap, trade restrictions, and blacklisting several individuals responsible for what are being described as these sham referenda. There's no other way to describe it. I mean, this is not real. Not when you've got soldiers with guns in the street overseeing the process. So all the member nations of the EU would need to green light. Hungary may not go along. The European Union has already imposed seven rounds of severe financial sanctions against Russia since the invasion, says the New York Times. An import on these selected Russian products would cost Moscow 7 billion euros, while prohibiting the export of European products such as aviation items, chemical substances, to weaken the Kremlin's military complex. I would just ask this question. I thought we were already putting maximum sanction pressure on Putin, on the Kremlin, in order to try to get the Russians, who have committed war crimes, who have committed untold atrocities, to back off and end this war. If there are these other sanctions that could have been imposed, why weren't they imposed already? What on earth are we waiting for? Do we have special leftover sanctions just in case they do something else? And aha, we're going to make it even tougher. how much are these sanctions even working? But I mean, it just seems to me, every time there's a new round, I ask the question, what took so long? Why isn't every bit of pressure being applied here, especially with Putin engaging in this incredibly reckless and irresponsible talk, rooted in desperation, about using nuclear weapons, even tactical nuclear weapons? I just don't get it. And in a related story here, since Vladimir announced this military mobilization, you know, caused by the fact that his army had to retreat again, as the Ukrainians bravely, courageously, and brilliantly recaptured a whole bunch of territory it had lost earlier in the war. About 200,000 Russians have left the country in an effort to avoid this draft, calling up the reservists, as it said. Now, the Russians say they have a pool of 25 million draft-eligible adults. But, so they may well be able to get the 300,000, but the whole idea was it was supposed to be people who already are in the reserves and have some military training. Obviously, a lot of Russians want no part of this. There was video yesterday, or in the last couple of days, showing long lines of cars approaching checkpoints in Mongolia, Kazakhstan, Georgia, and Finland. Couldn't be a more stark display of how unpopular this war has become at home. I mean, originally it was going to be a cakewalk, right? Drop some bombs, take over Kyiv. That didn't happen. And now the Russians have suffered heavy losses, so they have to go to the draft. Here is a guy, Alexander Olenikov, 29-year-old bus driver from Moscow, who crossed overland into northeastern Georgia. He said, I left because of my disagreement with the current government in Russia. He said many people he knew were against the war, which he called a tragedy caused by one crazy dictator. Look, the guy gave his full name. He better not go back or they'll find him. Now, how did the Times arrive at these numbers? The government of Kazakhstan said 98,000 Russians had entered the country just in the last week. Georgia's interior minister said more than 53,000 people had crossed into the country since the mobilization was announced. And, you know, Russia's fighting back. State news media reporting that the men waiting to flee at the Georgia border were being served call-up papers. So if they can intercept them at the time, then that makes it more difficult. Look, between the demonstrations and the arrests and the fact that the people in Russia now get it, they see the high price being paid by their country. You know, all those Russians who've been killed, in part because they don't have any motivation. They didn't want this war. They were told it would be a cakewalk, to recycle a word from the Iraq War. Slam dunk was also one of the words used when the U.S. invaded Iraq under George W. Bush. And it's no longer a secret what's happening. Putin's desperation is becoming clear. Many men do not want to be drafted in this war, so they are fleeing by any means necessary. And, you know, for a lot of unfortunate Russian families who maybe were afraid to speak out, the impact of the war is coming home in their sons or nephews, friends who never came back. And so I think this could be a potential turning point. Moving on to number three, as the Washington Post reports, hackers got into the internal computer systems at Fast Company magazine and then proceeded to deface the news site and send racist push notifications through Apple News to iPhone users. And so if you're sitting there on your iPhone and you don't know what's going on, the push notifications were attributed to Fast Company, and contain the N-word and graphic language, prompting shocked users to post screenshots on Twitter. Now, obviously, certain kinds of security breaches at these companies are not unheard of, but as the Washington Post reports, this was one of the biggest violations of Apple's so-called gated community or walled garden in memory. There was nothing to indicate that user security is compromised beyond the fact that you would have to think, if you stop and think for a second, why would Fast Company be sending out this racist garbage? So the magazine said by email that Fast Company's Apple News account was hacked on Tuesday evening. Two obscene and racist push notifications were sent about a minute apart. We are investigating the situation. The messages are vile. We have suspended the feed and shut down fastcompany.com till we're certain the situation has been resolved. There was also a tweet from Apple News saying an incredibly offensive alert was sent by Fast Company, which has been hacked. Apple News has disabled the channel. Apple News is a pretty popular thing that people go to, all kinds of newspapers, magazines, networks participate in Apple News. So the defacing, I mean, it's just disgusting. What was the motivation of the hackers other than to show that they could do it? And makes you think about how vulnerable everything on the internet is, let's face it.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Number four, there's a piece in The Atlantic about whether or not successful authors need to be online. My knee-jerk reaction is, yeah, I think so. Nicole Chung writes that your social media reach, could potentially signal to a publishing team that you know a bunch of great writers who will be excited to talk about your book, or help them determine how much online outreach they'll need to do on your behalf if you don't engage much there. Having a gigantic following has probably helped some folks get larger advances. Ding, ding, ding. I know a few authors whose publishers have asked them to give social media a go or reconsider their decision to leave. It becomes clear she's not a fan. But your online presence, she says, is only one of many factors involved in the decision to make an offer or not. And less important than, the actual quality of your book, how many copies a publisher thinks they can sell, etc. A small Twitter following shouldn't be a deal breaker. I think, says Chung, one key to maintaining an online presence is finding a platform you can tolerate and only following people whose writing and opinions you actually want to read. You're not going to get anything out of it if it's an unqualified misery for you. This is why I deactivated Facebook a while ago, she says. If you can't stand Twitter but still want to directly reach and engage with readers in some other way, maybe Instagram or a newsletter or some other platform is how you do that. It's worth noting that being on social media won't benefit you much if you're only there to talk about your writing or the book you hope to sell. For us non-famous writers, it's not an effective tool unless you spend time following, chatting with, and interacting with others. In other words, you got to be more personal about it. It can't all be promotional. Even if you enjoy certain aspects of this, like seeing people's very good dogs and connecting with and sharing the work of writers you admire, engagement does come at a cost. Every moment you spend scrolling is a moment you're not writing. Okay, well, even the best, most productive writers need to take a break now and then. It can be wearying to spend a lot of time on sites where lies, misinformation, and threats often spread without significant checks. You might be subject to harassment or abuse. She's trying to talk people out of it, folks. Self-promotion makes many of us cringe and others of us anxious. I'm sorry, you want to be a successful author, journalist, or anything else these days? You better get used to the idea of self-promotion. I mean, it's everywhere. How many times do you get a survey? You go to, Amazon and you buy something, or you go to the hospital, or you go to, the New York Times, if you go to their live feed, the paper's live feed, a thing pops up. Tell us how we're doing. Do you like the live feed? That's life in the digital age, folks. And if you're too shy or averse to self-promotion, you can't stand social media, okay, don't do it. But I do think you got to recognize that you want to sell things. And maybe it's just like, you know, the pottery you make or something. You got to get out there. We live in a digital age. I don't think you can ignore it. You want to ignore it, fine. But I think it makes you less effective. All right, number five, Katie Couric, who, because she lost her first husband, Jay, to cancer, let's see now, about 25 years ago, she became a crusader against cancer. And you remember back in the days when she was on the Today Show, she underwent a colonoscopy on TV to encourage other people to get colonoscopies. And so her life and that of her family have already been touched by cancer. Well, now, Katie Couric revealed yesterday that she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And she says, you know, others in her family have a history of cancer, but not breast cancer. So given that history, she thought, why would I be spared? My reaction went from why me to why not me? Breast cancer was a new one. I practically become an expert, she writes, on colon and pancreatic cancers, but no one in my family ever had breast cancer. She was told your tumor is highly treatable, particularly if it was detected early. So she then has this long post complete with lots of photos of her in the hospital gowns with the team. She goes all in on telling the story, and that's classic Katie. I've known Katie Couric for a long time. Some people like her. Some people don't like her. Some people like her journalism. Some people didn't like her journalism. And she's still active in journalism, obviously, but not as the CBS Evening News anchor or Today Show co-anchor or with Yahoo or any of those things. And it made me sad to read this. And it also, I also had to say to myself, this is classic Katie, that she's going to make a teachable moment out of it. So it was decided in consultation with her doctors that she would have a lumpectomy. I'll just read from this. The doctor would make an incision right around my aureola. She said she tried to make sure any scars would be covered by my bathing suit, the furthest thing from my mind. Surgery would be followed by radiation and medication. One of those medicines being something I would need to take for 5 years. When the diagnosis was settled, she FaceTimed with her two daughters, Carrie and Ellie. They started to cry, naturally. She told them I'm going to be fine, trying to convince myself as well as them. They'd already lost one parent. The idea of losing another was unfathomable. She says that when the tumor was cut out through this lumpectomy, it was bigger than expected. She writes that yesterday was my final round of the, I guess, chemical treatment. My left breast does look like I've been sunbathing topless, but other than that, I felt fine. Please, says Katie, get your annual mammogram. I was 6 months late this time. She'd lost track of time. There was the pandemic and all of that. And, you know, I'm glad it looks like she will be fine. It's still an awful thing to go through. I'm also glad that it was detected early enough that she can say that with some confidence. I'm also glad that she's documented it because, you know, a lot of people, a lot of women look up to Katie Couric. They remember her from the Today Show, from the colonoscopy on the air and all of that. And maybe they would let their annual mammogram slide. That's not a thing to do. Early detection is everything in these matters. So hats off to Katie. Good for her for taking some tough personal news and sharing it with everybody in order to try to help others. Well, on that note, thank you for listening. as always, try to share as much as we can on this podcast. I'd appreciate it if you'd subscribe. And we'll see you tomorrow back here with more BuzzMeter.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.